Welcome to another C-Control podcast, your moment of PowerPoint rehab from the Center for International Maritime Security. This week, we continue the Falklands series with Alex Clark of the Phoenix Think Tank. He brings to us a small panel on the British Army's involvement in the Falklands War with two fantastic guests. Hugh Pike, retired from the British Army as a lieutenant general, but in 1982 he was a colonel in the 3rd Para. He's written From the Front, Family Letters and Diaries from 1900 to Falklands and Afghanistan. And Alex Clark said that this was a really good book. He is also joined by Philip Neen, major in the 2nd Para, who was written about in Above All Courage by Max Arthur. As I said with the last iteration of our Falklands series podcast, this is a really great listen, and we will get back to Alex Clark after this short break.
Do you like the Sea Control podcast?
Sure, we all do.
However, we're only a small sea in the ocean of content available to you, our dear listener, at the SimSec website. Sign up for a membership at www.cimsec.org/about/membership. China may have a 9-dash line, but our seas are clear, and we welcome your opinions and articles. Please take a moment while downloading this podcast to leave us a 5-star rating and a comment. We need them. Seriously, how do you think we pay this electric bill? Money?
So the question I always start this off with, and I have had people give me a range of answers on this podcast, it was, what was the first thing that went through your head when you heard you were going to war?
Well, I think the first thing that the first feeling one I had, which I'm sure was common to everyone in certainly in 3 Para and 2 Para, and the Royal Marines, no doubt also, was great excitement at the opportunity. But I think alongside that was a recognition that the Argentines, you know, as we still were still sitting in Tidworth, sort of just sort of thinking about the Argentines, that they were had a very well equipped air force. They had a strongish navy, a big army, and lots of pretty good kit. And in other words, they were a sort of combined arm, a proper combined arms enemy, which we had not really confronted since the Korean War. In any serious way, a bit of an adventure at Suez, as you know. But otherwise, it was all sort of brush fire, counter-terrorism, and above all, Northern Ireland. And so we had to start unlearning some of the not bad habits, but the particular procedures, especially to do with casualties, that were necessary in situations like Northern Ireland, of completely different non-war fighting situations. That was my first reaction.
I think I would echo exactly what Hugh said. I'd only add on sort of personal level that, and I think it probably wasn't just me, but a lot of other people thinking, this isn't really going to end in war. You know, we're going to sail south and we'll have a cruise in the sun, you know, but common sense must surely prevail. And they'll all cruise back and, you know, nothing will happen. I think there was a strong feeling of that, and I guess that dramatically changed really with the sinking of the Belgrano and then the Sheffield, when I think at that point probably, you know, the penny dropped that, you know, this wasn't going to end in negotiation and, you know, blood had been spilled and, you know, more was going to have to follow.
Yes, I think I would very much agree with what Phil just said. I mean, there was as we went south, you know, there was all the logistic re-staring at Ascension, and then the beginning of planning for options and that kind of thing, and the onset of ships being hit and casualties. You know, became, the reality of what we were confronting became increasingly stark. And meanwhile, I think we were all quite dependent on listening to BBC World Service to find out what was going on in the political sphere. And that was, you know, I think as Phil quite rightly recalls, and I remember the same thing, there was a lot of discussion about, well, let's hope at least we land and sort of, you know, complete the mission sort of thing, whatever the mission turned out to be. But increasingly, as the realities homed in on us, then it became apparent we were going to land and do some serious business.
I have to say, those both sound far more sensible than I have to admit one person gave me the point of view, although perhaps theirs was very accurate for them at the young time, because they were quite a junior officer. And their reaction was, how many jelly babies will I need to pack and take with me?
Well, I mean, I don't know who you were talking to. Probably so it doesn't sound like a person particularly worth talking to, with great respect.
Actually,
well, I hope he was in parachute regiment.
No, not paras, no. A very technical engineering officer. I'll leave it at that one.
Right.
I think I edited that bit out of the final podcast when it comes out. Yes.
Okay.
I think it was his way of trying to calculate how long he'd be down there, how many packs of, you know, those would he need.
Sure.
But, okay, moving on from that, the question I've asked, and this has created a range of discussions, and you've sort of led into it already, how well do you think your training had prepared you for the war you were going to face in the Falklands? How well prepared do you think you were for that?
Philip, do you want to start like that? I don't want to always start.
Okay.
You start.
Yeah. It's quite a difficult one. I think in many ways we were quite well trained, up to sort of company level. We'd gone and recently done an all-arms exercise in Kenya, which was a sort of fairly good transition to two para from its previous tour in Northern Ireland, and then he was already spoken of the sort of difference between Northern Ireland and what we were about to face. I would say, in all honesty, at battalion level, we were undertrained. We had not really worked on battalion level all-armed attack and so on. It had all been very much at company level. So, I think there were gaps. I mean, I think in many ways we were, at a sort of micro level, quite well, you know, we were really very well prepared. I think that mentally we were particularly well prepared, and I, you know, pay tribute to H for that. But I think at battalion level we were a bit adrift in terms of, you know, the sort of technical aspects of an all-arms battle.
Yeah, I mean, I would certainly, as a battalion commander, I would certainly agree with what Phil has just said about the sort of combined arms aspect of battalion procedures, and in particular, I mean, Phil said that two para had trained in Kenya, which of course they had. We had been on a similar kind of exercise, sort of all arms, sort of war fighting training, if you like, is supported by a battery of artillery in Alberta in Canada, the previous sort of late summer. So about sort of, I don't know, 4 or 5 months before maybe. And that was very good, but even so, I think one great weakness we had, we actually did not have our own artillery battery. We were, with the background, as you probably know, was the 5 Airborne Brigade were kind of reforming, having been dispersed in the sort of, second half of the 70s, all over the place. And, we did not have our affiliated artillery battery. So we were very unused to dealing with battery commanders, forward observation officers, OPs, that kind of thing. And we weren't really, I don't think we were, our thinking was, we were not sufficiently aware of the importance of intimate artillery fire and how best to use it. So we certainly learned that as we went along. And equally, I think, and this is a sort of a fundamental, really, as we're talking about indirect fire, I mean, not a single man in the battalion had ever been exposed, except as a sort of on a demonstration or something, to the experience of indirect fire, heavy mortar, artillery, whatever. And that was, again, so it's up, that was something that kind of we experienced as we went along and fought a battle. I think another important point to make probably is that and it picks up what Phil was just saying about H. Jones, with which I concur, of course, is that the parachute regiment training and P Company and all of that and the recruit training was far from perfect, and of course it doesn't produce a completely rounded, sort of, if you like, soldier ready to go to war, but it does produce a guy with a kind of, a terrific amount of self-confidence, sometimes somewhat misplaced, you might say, but even so, the training that we give our soldiers does give them a level of self-confidence and a sort of confidence they can actually do whatever they're asked to do, which is hugely important in war, because you're always being asked to do things which you were never expecting to be asked to do. That's the nature of war. And so I think that was at the fundamental level, that sort of spirit of confidence and if you like, we'll do it, what is it kind of thing, is hugely important factor for our, and a particular characteristic of our soldiers and the way we train them and prepare them.
Let me just add a quick thing to that, actually, because Hugh makes a great point, and it's almost, you know, the training that we do instills a complete belief in ourselves, you know, as a unit, and you know, I mean, I absolutely no doubt in my mind, if you sort of look at Goosebean and so on, it was that belief that won the day rather than material assets or technical capability.
Yeah.
And, you know, many a person has made the point that, you know, it's often a question of the state of mind rather than anything else.
I think
we have the right state of mind. I think the Argentinians probably lack that.
And the other thing which, the old Napoleonic thing of the moral is to the physical is 3 is to 1 and all of that. But the other thing that, that struck me throughout the campaign, apart from the close quarter battle, which was again was something which none of us had ever experienced before, in all its awfulness. But the other feeling I had throughout the campaign was that we were on very familiar terrain. I mean, I mean that literally. I mean, the terrain was very familiar. But it was just like sort of mid Wales or somewhere, or the Western Isles. But it was also that the nature of the campaign was very suited to the way I think Royal Marines and parachute regiment soldiers are sort of, brought up. And as we've said already, I mean, and the general sort of environment in which they're taught to how to look after themselves in the field and, thrive on it and feel good about themselves and all this kind of thing. So it was almost, disrespectful to the Almighty. It was almost as if the Almighty had ordained that we should be given this rather suitable campaign to fight. And of course that was hugely, helpful to people's general confidence and their ability to prevail over the conditions as well as over the enemy.
And also prevail over the inevitable cock-ups.
Yeah,
I think we're all used to that, and now
Yeah,
just another exercise.
Yeah, exactly.
I will say I'm enjoying this podcast because I'm having to do rather less prodding than I have in some others. It's nice to have two talkative people.
Thank you.
try not to be too talkative then.
So, how do you keep, you know, you've spoken a lot about their training and their fitness and their mental and morale of your troops. How did you keep that up when they were going on ships and they were spending their time on ships going down south? Because the paras aren't sort of like the Royal Marines. They're not, they don't to an extent expect to be spending God knows how many weeks on a ship in transit. They're usually more on the plane, get flown there, and then have to jump out at the end or get landed. What was it? Was there sort of, did you go nick some ideas off the Royal Marines, or did you have your own on how
to? No, I don't think we did, needed to do that at all. I mean, it goes back to the point we both made earlier that, you know, that life in a part of the army like either the Royal Marines or the Parachute Regiment is one of, you know, response to the unexpected, really. I mean, that's our business. And so, you know, we were in a, say we were going to war in a way which was not necessarily particularly familiar to us, but that was something of a sort of, you know, an enjoyable novelty in a way. But I mean, the more serious point is that on board, the Canberra, I'm sure it was on the same on the Norland, we were very busy. I mean, the training program was pretty constant. The Canberra was a bigger ship than the Norland, and so, you know, 4 miles round the promenade deck was a mile. So there was a chance to keep physically fit, and also lots of opportunities to, you know, to move groups around the ship, bearing in mind we had 3 battalions on the Canberra, 2 Royal Marine commandos and ourselves. Slot into, you know, a very highly detailed, organized training schedule. And then we had periods, well, we had one period ashore on Ascension Island for 24 hours. I think the end not even 24 hours a day. But I think the only thing we did use the Royal Marines for was to, just sort of pick their brains and get the procedures for outloading sorted out, because obviously that was not something we were particularly familiar with in the context of an amphibious operation. So we did, you know, obviously sort of pick their brains on that, and that was very useful.
I broadly agree. On the Norland, the ship to ourselves, bar a few RAF Harrier pilots. Lots of attention to physical activity, physical fitness and so on, you know, keeping busy throughout the day. It's almost a common sense approach, really. You know, we were all well aware that if we sat and did nothing, then we weren't going to be in a fit state once we did go ashore after a 4-week cruise. I think the only area slightly you differ with Hugh on this is that, you know, we found the I'll say this with Julian Thompson not on the call at the moment. We found the Marines in some respects a little bit patronizing, that we had been taken through this amphibious disembarking drill at great length. And really, there's not a great deal of difference in my view between that and, you know, organizing a parachute drop. It's just, you know, work through the processes and follow them. And so we went through the little drills with the Marines that we had on board and so on, and you know, thanked them very much, but, you know, at the end of the day, we all thought it's common sense.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I can give you a specific example of, you know, the kind of thing that I think was reflected very well in answer to your earlier question about the training standards of the battalion and the capacity of the battalion to respond to, you know, changes of plan and that kind of thing, which of course went on all the way through the war. But whenever it was, believe it or not, I mean, two days, I think, or maybe in 3 before D-Day, the plan suddenly changed, and instead of outloading from the Canberra, we found ourselves quite rightly on the principle that there should be only one battalion per ship. As we went on the final run into San Carlos water, that we would cross deck to HMS Intrepid, which we duly did, mostly by landing craft, but at very short notice,
you know, in the sort of early hours of, we had the warning order in the middle of the night, and the early hours of the following morning we were kind of on the, you know, in the process of them getting onto this very overcrowded ship, HMS Intrepid. But we did all that without any problems at all, basically. There was a lunatic, with great respect on lunatic, senior Royal Naval officer, Beagleburn, Captain Beagleburn, very gallant officer, on the, Canberra with us, who was convinced that he was about to arrange, a Jack Stray transfer of three power, one man at a time. And this had been, never been done before in the whole history of the Royal Navy. And I told him he was completely mad, and we had far too much ammunition and heavy stuff to be moved to even dream of going by Jack Stay transfer one man at a time. Anyway.
But just think of the fun and the memories your men would have had to be able to take home.
Yeah. Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Yes,
and moving on from that, what was it like taking part in the amphibious assault? What was it like having to do that mission? And I will add in a little cut of salt. I think it was Free Para. They had more time at Ascension than Second Para. And if I remember correctly, one statistic I remember reading, and I think I was told this again in another podcast, is you used 10 years worth of anti-tank ammunition in one day.
Well, yeah, but I mean, just to pick up that particular point, that was a fun statistic, but it reflected, even worse than that. It was something like, I can't remember how many, anyway, it was much more than 10 years worth of the live allocation of HESH, wombat anti-tank ammunition, but the allocation was only two a year per gun. That, the peacetime allocation of live rounds. So, but it was a great statistic to be able to trot out afterwards. I think it was 36 years worth or something of live ammunition we fired on the Ascension in one afternoon. But we only won.
That's not a great deal.
Quite. But the only we only had one day ashore. Otherwise, we were on the Canberra throughout. We had one day ashore, which was a kind of a practice outload, as far as I remember. But then we, of course, ultimately we outloaded from a completely different ship. So when you say what it was like. I mean, I can tell you what it was like on, very briefly, on Intrepid, which was in severe overload, and they were great to us on board Intrepid. But, it wasn't the most impressive, let alone glamorous, examples of sort of daring do. I mean, we were, crammed into corridors and queuing to get off into the because you outload into the flooded dock of the into the big landing craft, and the little landing craft you go down from gantries in. But the most serious point was that we were severely delayed for reasons which again are an inevitability of such operations. We were supposed to go ashore in darkness, and of course which Tupara did, I think Phil will say in a minute.
Yes.
But it was actually broad daylight and early morning, beautiful early mornings, sun just rising when we finally got into our landing craft and started to go ashore into Port San Carlos. And just as a sort of commentary on the whole business of amphibiosity, I mean, it was absolute common sense that the safest place for us to be was ashore as quickly as possible. And you know, I was extremely anxious to get moving, and so it's a quite completely different story, I know. But so when it came to the ghastly tragedy in Bluff Cove, I simply couldn't understand, you know, how on earth anyone could sit around on board an LSL in that case, on a beautiful fine day, with the threat of enemy air that sadly developed. But there we go. So, I mean, as Phil has said, really, amphibious operations, you know, common sense, really.
I think, the Glasgow Fitzroy incident with the Galahad, we couldn't believe the guy, but I mean, it just seemed that somewhere along the line, the people involved hadn't made the transition, the sort of mental transition from training to operations, and it just seemed to be so avoidable. But in terms of Two Powers experience, I mean, yeah, we went ashore at night. It was exactly as we expected it to be, really, transferring onto landing craft. I wouldn't call it an amphibious assault, but it was an amphibious landing. The most dangerous part was probably stepping from the sort of side door on the Norland into one of the landing craft, with the risk of getting your leg crushed in the swell, sort of one ship bumping against the other, bearing in mind we're all carrying about 80 pounds at least. But the thing that I remember most of all was bearing in mind the Norland was a North Sea ferry being used as an amphibious assault ship, was the master of the Norland, Don Ellaby, coming up on the loudspeaker when in the darkened ship we were all getting lining up to start to transfer into the landing craft, and came up and very, very movingly addressed us as if we were a bunch of passengers he was about to put ashore at Rotterdam, with the lines of, well, you've been a grand bunch of passengers, and we hope you have a good time ashore, and we look forward to sailing you, bringing you all home safely shortly. Yeah. Well, you know, that got the old heart ticking a bit. It's a wonderful little valedictory speech that he tends to ashore with. Absolutely unbelievable.
Yeah, very nice. Yeah.
And helps with the morale.
Oh yeah, I mean that man absolutely had the right word for the moment.
Yeah.
How were operations once you got ashore? What was it sort of? What was your experience of them, especially the early operations, not the ones sort of on the final?
Well, perhaps I can make a general comment on that. I mean, I don't know how long you want to go on for, but from a battalion commander's perspective, I mean the as you probably are aware, we spent about 5 days in the bridgehead, and I think it was on the 25th of May, as far as I remember, which is the day the Atlantic conveyor was hit and all of that. Again, this is a very good example of how situations can sort of change very, very quickly, and you have to be able to react to it. But I remember sitting with, it's the last time I saw H. Jones, actually, was at the brigade commander's little O group in San Carlos. At that stage, most of the helicopters had been lost, and logistic situation was not looking very, very clever. The Argentine Air were sort of all over the shipping. And as we know, on the whole, sort of not going for logistic targets, thankfully. But Brigadier Thompson's attitude, approach, which was absolutely right in my view and understandable, was there could be no, advance, no sort of general sort of development out of the bridgehead until he was sort of logistically balanced, as quote unquote, which is a sort of military phrase, fairly self-evident what it means. And he was able to support forward operations with proper logistic support with ammunition and supplies and all the rest of it. The first few days, that reflects, I think, the fact the first few days ashore were, again, days of some uncertainty. Phil will talk about Two Powers experience, which of course was very specifically to do with the developing situation south in Darwin Goose Green, in a moment. And then for us, having been going round the positions, our positions in Port San Carlos, basically telling the boys that we were stuck there for a bit. And then overnight it all changed, and we found ourselves on the move to in our case, towards Teal Inlet, advancing on that northern axis. And in fact, I had sort of, we were supposed initially to advance behind 4-5 Commando to Douglas Settlement, and then do a sort of dog's leg through Douglas Settlement. And I explained to Julian that the settlement manager at Port San Carlos had told me there was a much more direct route, and which he used to take on his motorbike. And I put this to the brigadier, who, being the man he was, said, "Well, go for it, yeah." And so we went on a much more direct route. We didn't, thank God, have to trail behind 4-5 Commando. So, you know, that's my kind of snapshot of what the first few days were like. Over to Phil now, who will no doubt talk about the developing, you know, the action towards Goose Green.
Yes, I think 5 days of sitting on Tussex Mountain, seeing the Argentinian air taking the Mickey out of the Navy and causing an awful lot of grief, wasn't affecting us, but it did in a way affect our morale, I think. And you know, there was sort of kind of quiet mutterings of, you know, here we go, here's another Crimea sort of thing. You know, when are we going to do something? And I think that the people were getting very frustrated with the inaction. And I think it probably, company commander level and below, we couldn't quite understand the delay and the hold up. I mean, in retrospect, I absolutely agree with you that you need to get balanced and properly set up. And, of course, you know, I think quite rightly, Julian's focus was, you know, this war is going to be won or lost around Stanley and nowhere else. But we were the people closest to Goose Green, and, you know, on a fine day, you could almost dream you could see it. And, you know, H was busting a gut to get down there and get involved. So, slightly different situation for us in that respect. Because I suppose, the truth be said, that because of where we were on the beachhead, we could see that, you know, unless we got involved at Goose Green, we were likely to be the people left guarding the beachhead. That wasn't going to shoot anyone at all. So there was this great sort of push to sort of go and, you know, do something. And, what emerged with Goose Green in the end, of course, was a very complex story in terms of, you know, the politics in Whitehall, H's sort of personal pushing for, you know, wanting to get stuck in, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, that perhaps is subject for another question, but that was the sort of mindset, that was the sort of discussion and feeling that was going on around Sussex Mountain.
Well, I mean, just as a further commentary, I mean, I'm sure this is probably more appropriate for you to talk to Julian Thompson about. He may have covered it already, but of course, again, I mean, his judgment of the man, as the man on the ground, was that he needed to get sort of sorted out and balanced and confident that he was able to support advances south and eastwards. I think it was an example of where the joint headquarters at Northwood and the war cabinet in London took a different view. And you know, one has to always remember that satellite communications were somewhat in their infancy, and so it wasn't that easy, to communicate with the brigadier, the senior guy on the ground. But basically, he was given a different judgment from London, if you like, to the judgment he was making himself on the ground, which is normally an absolute military no-no. But in this case, and I think you probably agree now, the war cabinet in London were absolutely right, albeit driven by political imperatives to get on with it. It was a big risk getting on with it. The whole thing had been a big risk from the start, so it made no difference in that respect.
I think it was a difference between tactically. What Julian wanted to do was, you know, absolutely sound, but is being overridden by strategic imperatives which were, you know, really being driven in Whitehall, you know, in terms of, you know, pressure to negotiate, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, clearly, well, in retrospect, you can understand absolutely the friction, and you could argue that, you know, both sides are absolutely right.
And
of course, Goose Green has become one of those operations which is talked about and has had a few programs done about it, but it's lots of books written about it, and it's become sort of an operation which is very much associated with the Falklands War. In fact, almost, and I would say they were certainly at least of equal value, the operation to seize Mount Kent has sort of disappeared. And everyone forgets that jump forward, because that one, to be fair, didn't have any action, but both had their own value in a sort of strategic sense, when you look at it. And it's a case of one's, because it got the action and had, well, the unfortunate loss of the colonel, which is never good, but the other one, which managed to skip most of the action, doesn't get talked about. Although it does have the best mental image I have of the entire war, which is of the Max Hastings having to carry a blowpipe missile.
Okay,
Can I just make
one comment, because Mr. Phil may think it's a bit of an impertinence because he was there and I wasn't, but on the Goose Green thing, because I don't think you're getting it quite right. I mean, the Goose Green was actually far more significant than anything that happened on Mount Kent, quite frankly. Although it was important, obviously, that we did, you know, take control of Mount Kent and use it to dominate and observe and all the rest of it. The whole point of Goose Green, was that battle, and I've been quoted as saying this in the past, and I'll say it again now, that, you know, that I think I said something along the lines before the Battle of Goose Green, we knew we must win. But after the Battle of Goose Green, we knew that we would win. And the significance of me saying that, and I think it's absolutely right, is that it was a moral turning point. I mean, Phil has just spoken about the frustration of sitting in the bridgehead, and indeed it was very frustrating indeed. And so here you had a battalion advancing and securing a very significant victory, if you like, success over tactical success over the enemy, and you know it just in soldierly military terms that meant A, that everyone else felt, well, bloody hell, they can do it, but so can we, but also in the context of sort of natural inter battalion rivalry, you know, people would say, well, you know, we'll bloody well do as well or better than they have. So it set alight the whole business of the development of Operations Eastward, that campaign. I mean, we were already on the move when it happened. We were already advancing, but it did transform, I would say, the absolute commitment of everyone to winning through, regardless. And so it was hugely important in that respect, regardless of whether it was particularly significant in the overall scheme of things, in terms of defeating the enemy and seizing the ground around Port Stanley and all the rest of that, which obviously had to be done.
Thank you.
I think, again, it comes down to this issue of tactics and strategy. You could argue that tactically Goose Green was irrelevant. You know, many would argue that it could just be masked, although as it was an airfield, you know, you might argue that would be a risk, with Pukeris being able to fly out of it and so on. But at the strategic level, of course, it became hugely important, but I think only hugely important in hindsight or after the events, because as Hugh has said, it stamped the whole
it became the tenor of the whole campaign.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And we talked about earlier about the sort of, you know, relative merits of assets over the rights, state of mind and so on. Well, you know, given the fact that we, you know, beat an Argentinian garrison three times our size and so on, from that point on, we asserted the, if you like, the sort of psychological mindset advantage. And I think from that moment, and again, it's sort of just another way of saying what Hugh has said, is that, you know, on our side at that point, you know, it's not a question of anything else, but we, you know, it's, we are going to win this. And from the Argentinian aspect, I think, you know, that was, you know, if you sort of look at it and sort of, put yourself in their shoes, you know, Christ, you know, we've just lost, you know, a major garrison of 1,200 against a battalion of 600. We're going to lose this. And, you know, so it became the psychological switch for the whole campaign. And I think, you know, exactly as Hugh said, from that moment on, the outcome was absolutely sure, one way or another, you know, it was going to be our war rather than the Argentinians. And I think we thought that, I think they thought that. Once you've got that state going, you're on the winner. And that's the real significance of it. And there were lots of arguments about, you know, whether it should have done, whether it was supposed to be just a raid or an attack and so on. And I think, you know, in many ways, sort of say, well, they're irrelevant. But again, it's another area where I would give absolute credit to H. H absolutely realized that if we were going to engage at Goose Green, there was only going to be one, you know, you couldn't just raid Goose Green because just supposing we'd raided, hit fierce opposition and decided to withdraw, well, it would have given the Argentinians a huge propaganda victory, wouldn't it? Because, I mean, they could have sort of said, you know, Argentinian garrison repulses Patriot battalion attack. And H was, I think, absolutely clear. It's going to be only one useful outcome from that, this battle, and that is not a raid, but that we take the settlements. And, you know, with an unargued victory. And he instilled that mindset and belief into the battalion. I just can't, in that respect, I can't speak highly enough of him, because I think, you know, many people would have probably blanched at what they faced.
Absolutely.
That's true. It certainly did take, well, it was, I do agree with you, it was the only option. Raiding Goose Green doesn't seem to, especially if you look at it, if you raided Goose Green and you won, you probably have ended up taking it anyway.
Yeah.
So if you raided, the only option with raiding it, it does, it's an attack.
If you raid and just do a bit of damage and then withdraw, I mean, it says nothing.
Yeah. But you said I remember just picking up the word raids, which is slightly, with great respect, it's probably a bit of a Royal Marine kind of word. And, you know, I can understand, you know, why raiding is very much in their sort of, in their lexicon, so to speak, as a sort of modus operandi. But, when we were, so to speak, stuck in the bridgehead, again, before the plan was changed from London, I mean, Julian Thompson, basically, his line was, okay, we're going to be here for a bit now, in this perimeter until we get balanced, but there will be raiding. And that was that, I do remember that, you know, and one did slightly wonder what the precise object of raiding was going to be, beyond the sort of, keeping our own spirits up, if you like, and the offensive spirit going, and also, giving the enemy a hard time. But who are we going to be raiding? I mean, there were no apparent enemy forces immediately confronting us. They were all, you know, back well towards, places like, Tielin, Estancia, and in our case, and then around Stanley.
Right then, well, we'll move, as I noticed it's already reaching the 50-minute mark, so I'm going to move on, because I realize this already looks like it's going to go longer than I did promise you it would take. Moving on, what were the biggest challenges you feel to moving across the islands? Because you ended up pretty much... There was a little bit of helicopter support, but quite a lot of the equipment you ended up having to carry across with you. What was that like? What were the problems? And, you know, how did you overcome them?
Can I just comment on that one first, too?
Go on, yeah.
I mean, very simply, when we got to Sussex Mountain, H, and as a battalion, we all sort of said, you know, we are not going to do that again with Bergens weighing 80, 90, 100 pounds. Wherever we go from now on, if we're going to, certainly in a position where we're likely then to engage the enemy, we're going to go live scale. So, you know, we moved down to Bergen, to Goose Green with our Bergens on live scale. It wasn't particularly comfortable, spending two nights in the open without your sleeping bag and all the other stuff. But that was the line. Obviously, Tripa had a different option because, you know, they had sort of the whole geography and the logistics of what they were trying to do was somewhat different. But that was very clear, view that we took right from the start. So, Goose Green light scales, and then, you know, when we eventually moved forward in reserve, the Sea Commando Brigade in the final battles again, you know, we went light scales and we just, you know, slept light and lived it because, you know, trying to shift that sort of stuff, and be operational, it seemed to us was beyond the wit of most men. But, I mean, H had you know, but certainly Tripa had a different experience in that respect.
Yeah. I mean, on our side, again, actually, from the outset, again, I in comparisons are not necessarily helpful in this kind of thing, but I know that 4-5 Commando did move very, very heavily laden towards Douglas Settlement. But we actually, by that time, and I think it's, again, it goes back to what we were saying to start, it was partly the sort of, the ethos, is a bit different. But I think that we certainly, from the outset, set off very, as light as possible. Again, no sleeping bags, were reliant, therefore, on our Bergens reaching us as they did, for example, when we got to Teal Inlet, having had two nights out in the on our journey there. Bergens and sleeping bags, including sleeping bags, were brought to us by light helicopter, but I think it may be Sea King, I can't remember now, but the Sea Kings, I think, ferried those forward for us. And then when we moved on again from, Teal Inlet to Estancia, similarly, our Bergens caught up with us afterwards, and that was very much the principle on which we operated throughout. So when you're moving, as light as possible, just with your ammunition, which weighed a hell of a lot anyway, of course, and radios and so forth. No comforts like sleeping bags or Bergens or extra ration and so forth. And that enabled us to move, as well as we possibly could move and as quickly as we possibly could move. And survive until the next pause. And that was again was exactly the principle we adopted throughout. And again, I think that reflects the fact it goes back to what we were saying at the beginning about the way we trained not only the way we trained our new young soldiers through their basic training, but the way we trained in the battalion as well. I mean, living in the field, light scales. Your heavier kit catching up with you when you were, hunkered down for a pause of some sort, and that kind of principle of operating.
And moving into the battles when you got there, what was...
Yeah, sorry, could I just one other point to add to that, which I think is quite important.
Okay.
Because, and this yeah, there are a couple of points to make, really. First of all, the Falkland Islanders themselves, with we had help from Alan Miller's son, age only 17 at the time, driving a tractor around Port San Carlos. We had a similar help from the Torsten family at Teal Inlet, driving tractors. And when we got to Estancia, a whole group of people, commanded by a woman called Trudy Morrison, the woman leading this lot, came with a whole, literally a convoy of tractors and trailers and so forth, and sledges as well, being dragged behind a tractor. And that's, for example, how we moved our Milan missiles forward, how we moved a lot of our mortar ammunition forward. So that's an important point to make. So, and it's all to do with improvisation, really. And which again is something we've discussed earlier. I mean, the fact that you have the kind of this ethos of resourcefulness and adapting to the circumstances and making the best with what you've got and finding a solution to a problem. That's what it's all about.
And did that very well. Let's, now, I'll restart the question because I think I was already phrasing it badly earlier.
Sorry.
No. Don't worry, I was phrasing it badly. What, in the fire, sort of now, sort of done the yomping, once you got to Stanley, what was it, what went through your mind when you started looking, and when you were approaching the final battles? Stanley, what were you thinking? What was the preparations you went through and you, how did you prepare your men?
Well, I mean, Phil might want to go back and talk about Goose Green, which, as we've discussed already, was the first battle of the campaign, apart from the Pebble Island raid and things like that. But the procedures we went through were exactly the procedures that that we use on every exercise and every training. Every time we're in a sort of similar training environment. And so the procedures of, reconnaissance, studying the ground, orders, briefings, models on the ground, all this kind of thing, and making sure everyone is as fully briefed as they possibly can be, for the execution of the plan. Then, as Renee that we'll discuss in a moment, once the, there's the famous adage that, no plan outlives the first contact with the enemy. And there's quite a lot of truth in that, of course. And, so, again, you're then back to this, the confidence that is engendered in the training of everyone through their sort of military development as soldiers, commanders and young soldiers alike, improvise and produce a solution when they're confronted with a problem that they were not expecting in their orders, which again is a commonplace. So that's the only comment I would make about the sort of preparatory side of it. I mean, apart from you obviously have your bombing up with ammunition and all that sort of thing. You have all the logistics side going on at the same time, obviously, and that's very, very important.
Again, I echo much of what he was said. I think our preparation started on the Norland, if not before, right from the day that people arrived at the depot, but certainly very important, some of the discussions, briefings that went on in the Norland, about what we'd like to face, what it's going to be like, how do we cope, down to sort of one might think insignificant detail about formation, exactly what we would carry. I mean, there's a sort of extraordinary debate about whether we bring bayonets ashore, and H was saying we're going to meet witness with firepower, we don't need bayonets. The Toms were sort of pretty unhappy about that, so eventually we won the argument with H by saying, well, they're very handy as standby tin openers. So he conceded on that point.
You know, so but all this, you see, I mean, I know it sort of sounds silly, but it's all kind of part of the preparation, part of the visualizing what's going to happen, which is so important as part of the preparation.
Yeah.
And so it's all going on, all the way down. And then, you know, for Goose Green, the first major engagement, you know, everyone with their hearts in their mouths, questioning themselves as to whether they were going to cope and so on. You know, starting really, once again, with leadership at the top being so important. You know, H left us with absolutely no doubt that, you know, we were going to end up in Goose Green. And he painted a very detailed, some criticize him for that, but for me it was important, a very detailed picture of how we were going to do it. Mm-hmm. That painted the picture, that enabled us to visualize getting to Goose Green. As he was said, we all knew at the end of the day that wasn't going to survive crossing the start line, but at least it gave us the picture to start with. And, and that's so important. Yeah. And, you know, I think that's what, you know, really got us through the screen in many respects. Then moving on to, you know, our subsequent engagement at Wireless Ridge, I mean, we'd already been through the sort of come as you are party, which is what Goose Green really was. And I think, you know, a lot of people sort of think, hey, you know, we've done our bit. Isn't it someone else's turn? But clearly it wasn't. So that presented another challenge in terms of preparing people. And again, I think it was extremely important there to sort of say, look, this isn't another Goose Green. You know, we've got fire support now in abundance, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that again all helped to build the sort of confidence factor. But, you know, there's no doubt that, you know, picking people up after one very kind of open-ended engagement at Goose Green and saying, now you've got to do it again, is a challenge. And you have to address it in one way or another.
Well,
as we're now definitely over the air, and I think everything's been pretty much covered, I have only one question left, and this is the question I pretty much finish every podcast with. What lessons that you learnt during the war would you have liked to have known before the war, and would you want to make sure were passed on to any future officers finding themselves in that situation?
I touched earlier on about the sort of business of the, if you like, the combined arms or all arms battle, in particular the integration of direct and indirect fire, if you like. In the jobs I did after this was an aspect of training and thinking which I did try to put a lot of emphasis on. Now, you know, we'd all been brought up through our own training from Santos onwards with the importance of, you know, the role of the supporting arms and all of that stuff. But the reality of just how important it was to get it really right and to train so that everyone understood their parts in relation to other people is something which, you know, I think that inevitably when you've experienced it, you do put a tremendous amount of emphasis on. I think the other points I would make are, you know, the awful reality of any kind of infantry battle and the casualties that result from that, and the way the procedure for identifying getting casualties back to a medic and then to an RAP and the regimental aid post and then so forth. So that whole procedure is hugely important. The resupply of ammunition forward is hugely, hugely important. I mean, these are fundamental things which on the whole get slightly glossed in training very often and are put in the sort of slightly in the too difficult category. Well, you know, they are the essence of the whole thing. I suppose that there are two aspects of the wider point, which is just trying to make training in terms of unexpected developments, unpleasant environments, you know, and so forth, as realistic as is safely possible, is all, you know, is what it's all about. And I know that in our regiment, that's what we try to achieve, difficult though it is. And I think it's all those aspects which an experience like we went through in 1982, I mean, it's those aspects which, you know, become very, very important to you after you've been through something like that.
Yes, I think the way you phrased the question, Alex, is difficult because the, you know, before, during and afterwards, I mean, actually, you know, when you look back, rather as you said, you know, there were no new lessons there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was all there in the early teaching, but had we really understood it? That's the question.
Yeah.
And, so kind of the things that crossed my mind in response to that question, and they echo a lot of what Hugh said, is, you know, the importance of fire support, the comparison between Goose Green, where we had, you might as well have said we had no fire support at all, but, you know, the gunners were completely useless on that occasion, compared with what we had at Wireless Ridge, was just dramatic. I mean, with the artillery we had at Wireless Ridge, you know, we didn't really, when it worked, there was no serious fighting through to be done. It was all done for us. It was just mopping up. So it's complete, you know, the significance of that was a huge lesson, really.
Mm.
I think we have already echoing things in terms of, you know, the mindset, you know, that if you get this sort of mindset right, I know it's a cliche, but, you know, that is all important. And again, I think perhaps before the Falklands, I think it's more widely recognized now, you know, that is a fundamental aspect of military command and leadership. Echoing Hugh again, robustness, you know, in the face of adversity, uncertainty, the unexpected, you know, just being able to be prepared to accept hardship, changes of plans in your stride and so on is so important. And then I think the other thing that was a real eye-opener for me was, again at Goose Green, and, you know, we go through it on exercises beforehand, the importance of reorganization and so on, but we had totally underestimated the actual difficulties of reorganization after a compact at night when it's pitch black, you've got casualties, you don't know where they are, you've the platoons are spread, you know, to all points of the compass, following up, you know, enemy contacts and so on, and then you have to try and regroup, reorganize, find your casualties and everything else. On exercise, it all seemed to take 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And on operations, you know, Goose Green, it took an hour and a half. And that, you know, was actually the fundamental flaw in Goose Green. We absolutely misappreciated that, and our time and space appreciation as a result went out of the window. And, you know, that was the fundamental flaw with Goose Green, in my view, was, you know, there were lots of things to criticize about Goose Green, lots of things to praise about it, but had we started that battle 4 hours earlier and completed it in darkness, it would have been a cakewalk.
Mm.
You know, leave aside the lack of fire support and so on. But the fact is that we totally underestimated the time it took to reorganize in those situations. Time went out the window, and we ended up, you know, halfway down the isthmus, and daylight comes up, and the whole thing flips. So that was the biggest eye-opener for me, really, of the before and afters. You know, in the real world, reorganization can take a long, long time.
Yeah. I mean, I think what, Phil's probably heard this quotation before, in which case I apologize, but I find, I, I came across this exit. It's quite, what I found one of the interesting things about the whole experience was that you read afterwards stuff which, and you kind of know whether it's rubbish or not, and the bits that aren't rubbish are really sort of, much more striking, I think, in a strange way, after you've had, this kind of experience. And this is actually, I think it was Gibbon in The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, talking about Alaric, the king of the Goths, and he describes, I've just scribbled it down now, actually, he describes Alaric, as having the invincible temper of mind, really important, the invincible temper of mind that rises superior to every misfortune, and you know, every campaign is just a sequence of misfortunes, really, and derives resources from adversity. And that's just so important. The ability of the soldier to derive resources from adversity is really what we've been talking about. And so that kind of sums up for me the quality of the soldier who is going to prevail in these very, very difficult adverse circumstances of warfare. Whether you're winning or losing is in a sense irrelevant. You know?
So yes, that's right. I think absolutely true. And again, just to draw the parallel with, if you like, my experience at Goose Green.
Yeah.
You know, daylight. We're only halfway through the mission. The advantage switches totally to the enemy. And yet we kept on going. So that is absolutely, in my mind, echoing
what
he was just said.
Thank you. That's been brilliant. Thank you very much for both of you. Thank you so much for doing this.